I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for Thursday, September 19th. 2 years after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico has turned from resilience to resistance.
The resistance that we saw this last July is a great example of how that resilience was always resistance.
We'll talk about how the hurricane reshaped the lives of Puerto Ricans on and off the island.
Many people are saying that their best shot at education or advancement in their careers or just mere survival is to stay in the United States.
Also on the show, as anxiety mounts over global warming, a look at how artists are trying to make sense of our changing environment.
What I'm really trying to do through my work is not let our fellow neighbors feel as if they're the victims, but that instead that they have a role to play.
As this approaches and becomes more urgent, it'll be unavoidable. It will just be present in our work because we're all dealing with it.
But first, Puerto Ricans on the move after Maria. Friday marks 2 years since Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, and 1 year since The Takeaway traveled to the island to report on its aftermath. An estimated 130,000 people left Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricanes Maria and Irma, and the island has lost at least 4% of its total population, according to the Census Bureau. Many ended up on the U.S. mainland, building lives in new places.
Hi, my name is Analita Now. I'm from Juncos, Puerto Rico.
Analí is one of the estimated 7,000 Puerto Ricans who came to Massachusetts in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. She landed in Springfield with her sister and nephews. Analí's nephews were suffering from health issues back in Puerto Rico, and after Maria, medication and clean water were hard to find.
In Puerto Rico, a lot of damage, so the hospital don't have the medicine, so the water was contaminated, like the water you use to take a shower.
Analí and her sister settled in Springfield because they had family there. And there was a small network of services and a Puerto Rican community that helped her get on her feet.
My grandma and my cousin and my brother lived here. So when we came, we started living with my cousin. And then the Red Cross helped us to get our shelter in a hotel. I meet a lot of people in the shelter, in the hotel. And I see a lot of community, like Puerto Rican community. So I make friends in the beginning, just one. And then I start working every Tuesday, and I meet another friend who helped us, was a good support for us.
Like so many people who had to leave Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, Analí is still very connected to the island, but she doesn't think she'll be able to go back.
I miss my island, my friends, my family. I have all my family in Puerto Rico, my mom, my dad, my cousins. I have my best friend. She says it's not good for her. She wants to come here too because in Puerto Rico she don't find like a good job, and she wants to create his future. So she don't see that in Puerto Rico. She don't have help there. So I like to live here. I miss my island, obviously. I see my future here. Puerto Rico don't have that for me.
It's clear that many people are saying that their best shot at education or advancement in their careers or just mere survival is to stay in the United States, which doesn't mean that people are necessarily entirely comfortable with that. Many do it with great reluctance, but definitely that they don't have as much faith in that things will improve in Puerto Rico fast enough for their children or for themselves.
That's Frances Negron Montaner, a Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and scholar. She's also a professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. And we've spoken to Frances periodically over this past year, and I asked her to join us again today to reflect on where Puerto Ricans have ended up in Maria's aftermath.
Puerto Ricans are moving to places that maybe there was very few Puerto Ricans, South Dakota, for instance, and that's a direct result of recruitment for labor there. We've seen people move to cities generally not associated with Puerto Rican migration, although there are some people there, like Minneapolis. Then you have an uptick in the number of people going to sites that already were experiencing a large influx, like Florida, but also a return to historic locations, like in Massachusetts, like in Pennsylvania, even in New York, that has been experiencing people leaving for Florida. Now there's more people coming in to areas like the Bronx.
Now, I mean, we can sort of say, oh, this is all wonderful. People are coming to the United States. They're finding, but there are tensions that you're noticing as well. Tell us about how those are playing out in the different populations that you're looking at.
Well, one of them is that a lot of people are going to Orlando area, Central Florida, where there's a very large number of Puerto Ricans, and thinking that might be the easiest transition to coming to the United States, but finding that more settled communities there are not necessarily as welcoming as they thought. Another one is I go back and forth to Puerto Rico a lot, and I often get engaged with people that are going to places like South Carolina or Nebraska, and what I hear them talking about is the family is divided about whether to stay or to return. And often it's children that have already been displaced from Puerto Rico. Once they settle, they also don't want to go back.
And that's something we heard our guests talking about at the top of the show. Well, the other thing that Annalie was talking about was how she was placed in a hotel. And that was the beginning of how she was able to get her feet on the ground. We talked about, you and I talked about the documentary film After Maria, which focused on one of those families. And it raised a lot of issues, a lot of uncomfortable issues about the displacement resources that were being given to families who were coming from the island to the continental United States. Well, help us understand a little bit about that tension, too. Like this idea that, you know, who is deserving of resources, who isn't, who is working, who isn't.
Well, at the heart of this mass migration after Maria is precisely the issue of recovery and resources. One of the reasons that people are leaving in such great numbers is employment or the economic austerity crisis. But another one is that promised funds for recovery in Puerto Rico have still not arrived at the level that they were allocated. So some of those people are deciding to try to access those resources by moving away from Puerto Rico to the United States, but often finding that the resources are not there or that people in those areas they're settling are resentful that they are demanding or requesting such resources.
This, of course, the aftermath of Hurricane Maria and also more recently the protests against Ricardo Rosselló and his government really, I think, reestablished some connections between the diaspora, folks who are Puerto Ricans who are here in the United States, in the continental United States, and those who are on the island. With this migration, with this new population settling, how do you see that affecting the diaspora, if at all?
One of the reasons that people are going to these historic areas of Puerto Rican settlement is because there are networks of support. I think the austerity crisis and the aftermath of Hurricane Maria demonstrated that there are a large number of Puerto Ricans in the United States that are very much in tune and invested in the future of Puerto Rico, even if they're not permanent residents there. On the other hand, you know, there are people in Puerto Rico that resent that too. I would say that it has changed, though. If you look at the similar tension 30, 40 years ago, there was much more resentment and rejection of New Yorkers or Puerto Ricans coming from the U.S. But I think I've heard many people in Puerto Rico express that they feel gratitude towards those Puerto Ricans from here that have used their resources and their voices to support them at a time of tremendous need.
Francis Negro Muntaner is a Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Francis, thanks to you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Puerto Ricans aren't happy with the political situation, and we are going to fight back.
We first spoke to Stephanie Nieves Rios last year when our team was on the island. Stephanie is an organizer working with La Olla Común, a Centro de Apoyo Mutuo, or Center for Mutual Support, which opened immediately following Hurricane Maria to help feed people in need.
Spaces like this, which isn't the only one, this is a network of mutual support centers, as well as other projects that popped up, kind of gave people space to both find that comfort and also to talk about these things.
I checked back in with Stephanie this week, and like Francis, she too has witnessed an exodus from the island.
Even though the initial disaster in the way that's visible passed, people are living the economic consequences of what it meant to shoulder this reconstruction on our own shoulders and not with the help that we deserved and were entitled to by both local and federal governments.
When I spoke to Stephanie in 2018, she echoed what we had heard from others, that the themes for Puerto Ricans 1 year later was resilience. But it seems like resistance might be a better word for the feeling on the island now.
Puerto Rico has had a wild summer of resistance. And to me, the resistance that we saw this last July is a great example of how that resilience was always resistance, and how people are now seeing that they can take that resistance that they live every day in their lives and turn it into action.
There are other political and social issues that are now coming to the surface in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about those.
We have a long history of these different chapters of the same capitalist model being applied in a different way. Hurricane Maria came around, but before that, we were already under the fiscal control of a supposed fiscal supervision board, which has absolute control over our economy, and that's still sustained. So when people lived this tragedy post-hurricane, when these chats came out to us on the ground, it was so much more clear that it's about all these other things that are happening. The university's tuition has already been raised. Pensions are also going to be drastically cut within the next couple of months. We've also had a dramatic increment in gender violence on the island since before the hurricane till today. And this year we're following a similar pattern. There's just all of these pieces happening at the same time. So we had this big movement towards Ricky Renuncia, and it's important because it showed people the power that they have. People aren't still protesting in Old San Juan, but they're meeting in people's assemblies to talk about what's happening on the island and think about solutions.
In addition to that, there's been an increase in the conversation even among elected officials in the United States Congress about whether or not Puerto Rico should become a state. Last year when we were there, we spoke with a University of Puerto Rico Rio Piedras student named Edgar Velasco. And at the time, he was the state chairman for the College Republican Federation of Puerto Rico. And I want to play for you his thoughts about statehood.
As a Republican, yes, I believe in statehood because I have seen how not being treated equally has resulted in a lot of the problems we have right now. Obviously, also mixed with bad administration, a lot of corruption cases over the years, and some other elements that have been sometimes our fault and sometimes more of a result of the whole status and situation, political situation we're in.
Stephanie, with everything that we've seen this year, is statehood part of the answer or the answer? Would that help the situation in Puerto Rico, in your opinion?
I agree with what he's saying in the beginning, right? There is an unfair treatment of Puerto Ricans. There is obviously a sub-citizenship. I think that what isn't included in that is the intentionality and the benefit that the United States gets from Puerto Rico being neither a state or an independent country. From my perspective, also seeing the capitalist logic leads to a lot of exploitation here on the island that is important to the model. I think our status as a colony is something that we have to battle against. And for me, that means working towards the independence of Puerto Rico and towards reparations from the United States to help Puerto Rico become a free country.
Stephanie Rios works with La Olla Común, a Centro de Apoyo Mutuo, or Center for Mutual Support, which opened immediately following Hurricane Maria. Stephanie, thanks for talking to us, and it's great to hear from you again.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
And we've got one more story on climate change for you this week. So far in our coverage, we've heard from psychologists, sociologists, and meteorologists. But we wanted to wrap up by hearing from some folks who are taking in the information researchers are presenting to the public about climate change and turning it into art. Karen Russell is a fiction writer, and her most recent book, Orange World, is a collection of short stories. And several of those stories use a fantastical lens to look at how humans are changing the environment.
In this new book, you know, it showed up in sort of surprising ways. There's a story about tornado rancher, you know, these people who are literally raising destructive weather on the Great Plains. And then there's maybe the most overt nod to the rising seas is the story of the Gondoliers, where, you know, this devastation has occurred. South Florida is basically underwater. There are these four echolocating sisters who are kind of, you know, they have these boats they call gondolas that they're using to traverse a watery South Florida. And they're pulling through the ruins of the old city, but something new wants to be born.
Sea level rise is also a central part of artist Xavier Cortada's work. Based in South Florida, he takes a slightly more unusual approach to incorporating climate change into his art. For his most recent project, he's asked residents of Miami-Dade County to plant mangrove seedlings in their yards to make the growing threat of sea level rise feel more urgent.
I made it as a provocative way of having us think about what would happen to us 30 years from now when this little 6-inch seedling I give you becomes a tree. What's going to happen to your mortgage and your home equity and your community? It is a way of us beginning to understand that sacrificing a little today may help lessen the suffering in the future.
And Aaron Stewart Ahn is a filmmaker who's made fiction and documentary movies. And recently, he's noticed that real life seems to be imitating Hollywood.
Something I struggle with is I follow a lot of climate scientists, and I'm watching them on Twitter talk in real time. And it is like dialogue out of a disaster movie. It really is. Like, you know, these are the scientists who are whipping off their glasses and saying, I've noticed the buoy marker is recording, you know, temperatures that are unprecedented. They're using a lot of words like that, and they seem really sad and shocked. So you can see that for yourself, and I think that finds its way into your work as you're trying to interpret it or come to terms with it somehow.
Aaron began our conversation by explaining some of the challenges that come with making documentaries about climate change.
A frustration my documentary filmmaker friends and I have is just that you can make documentaries about this issue, but we are in an era where it feels like we have hyper-awareness of everything, but how do you actually move the needle? You know, you can get people to watch documentaries about this issue, but what happens afterwards? And when these cultural pieces are held in a film festival or some domain like that, they play there, it gets some acclaim, but that doesn't really get people out in the streets advocating for change in policy, which is really important.
And Xavier, to that point, I mean, your work is asking people directly to engage with the topic.
Absolutely,
right now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so do people get uncomfortable when you ask them to confront climate change so directly?
So I try to reframe the way people think and make it relevant to them. I'll give you one example. A couple of years ago, I was in Hialeah. Hialeah, Florida is a city that has a lot of Cuban exiles, Cuban political refugees who left everything they had, everything, and had to leave Cuba over the course of the last 6 decades to build a new life because of an external force, in that case, the Cuban Revolution. Right? So you leave with a suitcase and you start a new life somewhere else and you make it work. And I sat with a group of elderly in a primarily, Republican district of Hialeah and talked to them about another external force that was coming that was going to make their grandchildren suffer the same fate that they felt, that instead of their grandchildren being political refugees, they could be climate refugees. And I asked them to write letters to their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, letters that we sealed and put in our archives, about what courage they had to do this and how it is that they found the strength to rebuild and start anew. And what I was really trying to do at the end of the day is build a cadre of citizens who understood that they needed to take action, that they themselves needed to be the change agents, that all of us were part of the art making, whether you're planting a mangrove or protecting our seagrasses. What I'm really trying to do through my work is not let our fellow neighbors feel as if they're the victims or that they're powerless, but that instead that they have a role to play. And I think by engaging in a creative activity where they themselves are the protagonists, where they themselves are the ones who are addressing the issue and facing it by reframing and talking about their very property values. In the case of Hialeah, most people think of Miami Beach and our coastal communities as the ones that are most affected because they're the ones on the water. But Greater Miami has a second coastline. It's the Everglades. It's basically a river of grass, and as sea level rises, it rises on both sides and from beneath. And I was wanting to alert these families who had to leave their properties because they were confiscated, and let them know that in the decades to come, their property values may pummel. and that they needed to find solutions. So by reframing it and making it about their shared experiences and about a future potential reality, it wasn't something that they rebelled against, but instead responded to.
Karen, in fiction, when I think about post-apocalyptic or doomsday scenarios that have gotten a lot of attention, maybe not so much focused on climate change, but just generally, I think about The Handmaid's Tale. And I think for a lot of folks, it's gotten tons of critical acclaim. It's in all of the places, and yet it's unwatchable for a lot of people who just find it's just too dark, too difficult. And so do you see examples of fiction writers, authors who've done a particularly effective job of bringing climate change into their work? Or do you think that those narratives, those doomsday narratives, are effective?
I think that tonally it's a real challenge, right? For people making art right now, we're also aware of the extremity of this sort of unfolding crisis. And I think you can really, in that crisis mindset, extrapolate to the darkest place. And I, you know, sometimes it's not the work itself, but sort of the pleasure people take in that, you know, you get stuck in this cul-de-sac of grief, right? Or you feel as an individual like these inertial forces are mounting. Humans are a cancer on the planet. There's nothing to be done. Which is so opposite what I think, you know, people like Aaron and Xavier want to inspire. And in fiction right now, you know, I'm thinking of Ursula K. Le Guin, who recently passed away, who for decades has been writing stories where you really feel there's an unborn potential. You know, there are alternatives to this order. It's not necessarily extrapolating from the darkest parts of people's natures in our past. I loved hearing Xavier talk about the mangroves, because the other work of fiction I've read recently that was so inspiring to me was Richard Powers' The Overstory. And he wrote this book as sort of a rejection of human exceptionalism, and the trees are the protagonists in concert with the humans, right? But it's just a much more expansive idea of what family looks like. It definitely is connected to this idea, you know, we share the water, we share the sky. So it's a more expansive idea of what home looks like. There's no sense that we're discrete actors. There's this real like tree consciousness that pervades it. And you're thinking instead of these isolated beings, you know, I think we can really think of ourselves as discrete actors, and that's a danger too. And here in this book, there's a model of how to think as a we, and a we that's even more expansive than sort of a human collective. It's humans, trees, animals, you know, it's a real network.
Aaron, I want to pose to you, and I'm dating myself here when I think about climate change in film. Yeah. I'm thinking Mad Max, post-apocalyptic hellscape. I'm thinking Waterworld. Because I cannot think of something, at least that Hollywood has done, yeah, that's more recent, that really sort of scratches to the surface.
Well, the funny thing would be Mad Max Fury Road, which is recent. It's the same filmmaker, and you know, 30 years on, he's addressing the same issue. But he also lives in Australia, where they are dealing with the death of the Great Barrier Reef and also droughts every summer. And I think is unbelievably potent and prescient, weird. Like, there's something about Fury Road that just distills our time in an extraordinary way. Like I was saying, I think it's happening in a sublimated way. And to follow up on what Karen was saying, it's interesting because I think there is a lot of pop culture entertainment that is in this post-apocalyptic vein. And I detect a sort of, like, I get a little wary. There's some sublimated desire in some of it where it's almost like comforting fiction. Like, there's an extremely popular television series about people, you know, surviving in America after a zombie outbreak that's been running for years. And I think, like, the zombie genre started as a sort of post-scarcity, you know, really subversive, like, being terrified of going to the mall and watching society break down with George Romero in the 60s. And now it's kind of become this comforting, like, people in small gangs with guns surviving America where all laws have vanished. And that doesn't address this. Like, it doesn't address the actual crisis that we're in. And so when Karen invokes Ursula K. Le Guin, or also, you know, Octavia Butler is kind of having a resurgence, I feel like we just need new voices, especially in genre like science fiction, to address, like, new visions, ways of seeing things. And the things I'm hopeful about, I was down at the Miami Film Festival this year, and I was really impressed by the young filmmakers I met. You know, I'm in my 40s, but the young filmmakers I met in Miami, some of them have deep roots in Puerto Rico, so they've just been through what happened there, and they're making documentaries about it. And they're only 21, 22, and I'm sure as their filmmaking skills improve and their access and their chances to make films, this is going to inform the fiction they make. Like, it's going to be indivisible. And I hope that, like, all of us, like, as this approaches and becomes more urgent, like, it'll be unavoidable. It will just be present in our work because we're all dealing with it. So Hollywood, I think, like, is stuck in a little bit of a mindset where they're still crafting these stories that they feel will be successful by presenting us this very safe, comforting way of handling the ideas of the, you know, collective unconscious sensation of what it feels like to feel that the world is ending. And they like to solve it in a really neat and tidy way. Yeah.
It works when your format is 90 minutes or, you know,
yes.
or eight episodes on Netflix. It kind of works.
Yeah.
Briefly, from each of you, is this something, climate change, something that at some point will inspire something like a Whitney Biennial or something like that? I mean, do you see this becoming more and more part of the mainstream entertainment world? And I know, Aaron, you sort of touched on that a little bit. Karen, I wonder about you. What do you think?
I think absolutely. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that sometimes news coverage, there's a financial incentive to keep people in terror, right? You know, you want those eyeballs glued to the screen. And I do really hope that in fiction, you know, Richard Powers, that book I mentioned, The Overstory, models a new kind of tale for me. And it's more subtle. It's maybe not as exciting as Mad Max. You know, it's the pleasures don't line up with the apocalyptic sense of, you know, the end of your life might be the end of all life. And I am really hopeful, actually, that there are new kinds of fiction. You know, there's that old trope about man versus nature, new kinds of fiction that kind of show us what interdependency feels like. You know, you're asked to sort of displace yourself from the center and enter this kind of collective world. And I think that is very exciting to me. It's visceral. You feel it on a gut level when you're reading what it is, you know, to be a non-human actor, to be a tree, you know, with roots, you know, reaching for the sky, to have these stories where humans still play a role, but maybe they're not central and exceptional. And I think that is a real consciousness shift that that a book can produce.
Xavier, last thoughts from you. Were we at a point where we'll see this expansion into more, quote unquote, mainstream art and entertainment?
Yeah, for me, culture, I think, allows us to communicate those ideas and really complex ideas in society and help transform society the same way it did during our civil rights struggle. I chair our regional arts council. I'm the chair of the Miami-Dade County Cultural Affairs Council. And my most important task to date has been to create a green task force to let the cultural community, the 500 cultural organizations that we fund, begin to walk the walk, to be more resilient and sustainable as organizations so that they can model that to the community. But more importantly, because in the years to come, I absolutely believe that all of our cultural producers are going to be addressing this issue. And I want them to understand the very important role that they play, not just in boardrooms and in the work that they do when they're not performing, but literally in the productions that they create and the voices that they elevate and in the communities that they inspire. So I do believe that arts has a really significant role to play, and that more and more this existential crisis that we're all facing as nation states collapse and famine happens and we undergo the sixth mass extinction and all that is going to fall and hurt us as a species and the animals and plants that we co-evolved with become more and more in focus. I know that art, that culture, that our humanity is going to be able to sing and get us through this. And I just want all of us to be prepared when that moment comes, understanding that each of us, inside of us, in our DNA, have the ability to effectuate that change.
Aaron, you get the last word.
And I'd have to follow up on what Xavier said. That was really beautiful. I think without a doubt it's happening. I have a South African friend, a science fiction writer named Lauren Bucus, and she just participated in something with a panel of Antarctic scientists where they were coming up with scenarios. I think like scientists are now reaching out to artists and trying to figure out how to communicate. And from what Xavier was saying, it's extraordinary because we may be losing a lot. So as artists right now, we may be recording what a time of life was before things changed. The next generation is going to do something really extraordinary. And I take hope too. Two things I think about constantly are that I was once in Cambodia making a film, totally unrelated, but I saw the way that people live on the Tonle Sap Lake, and they live on boats in these extraordinary constructions where they have, you know, like boats that have basketball courts, pig farms, they're complete horticultural centers, and children are running and jumping between boats, and these people have adapted to live where they have food all year round because there's fishing. in an aquatic way. And in the West, we don't have that vision yet. And I think that's like a potential hope. Like people do adapt. Like I don't think there's hopelessness here. Things are going to change. I think a lot of culture is like reacting in the sense of, I'm scared of that and I don't know how to process that. So, and as Karen brought up, then the author is presenting the idea that their death is going to be the death of everything, which is a really dangerous place. But I see possibilities. There are factors here that are greater that we're not taking into account that offer some hope. You know, I hope we all think about those things, that there are unprecedented ideas for change that we can't expect yet, and we're here to witness it and record it and discuss it.
And let's end on a wonderful note of hope. Aaron Stewart Ahn is a writer and filmmaker. Karen Russell is the author of Swamplandia and Orange World. And Xavier Cortada is an artist and professor of practice at the University of Miami. Thanks to you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thanks. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening. And you can hear all of our climate coverage from this week at thetakeaway.org/coveringclimatenow. And a shout out to our production team that made the show possible this week. Producers Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Jivika Varma, Jose Olivares, Jason Tureski, Andres O'Hara, and Meg Dalton. Polly Irungu is our digital producer. Our intern is Lita Hollowell. Vince Fairchild was our director this week, and Debbie Daughtry and Claire McKean were our engineers. David Gable is our administrative assistant, Alexandra Boti is our senior producer, and Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from. Whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.